This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Andrew Steeves. He's the co-founder of a Canadian publishing company called Gaspereau Press. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for calling.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. It's not often that I get to speak to someone who is in a time zone ahead of me and who is on the same continent, which I think describes Nova Scotia to some extent.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're in Kentfield. Do I have that?
Kentfield, Nova Scotia. It's a little town, maybe 6,000 people kind of thing. It's the sort of county seat, so the courthouse is here, and one of those classic sort of two-story brick building, one-way square, small towns.
And so, what got you to know? I mean, are you from Nova Scotia?
I'm from New Brunswick, which is just sort of next door, you know, just north of Maine, right? So I grew up there and then did some university in Ontario for a while and ended up back here, wanted to get back to a little slower pace of life and like Nova Scotia and just sort of landed here. No job, no plan, just here we arrived.
and I guess you have a partner and you've got a bunch of people working for you, which, you know, today I think is unusual for a small publisher to be successful enough to have employees. But I think you started out with a magazine. This is going back to 1997 when you started, so it's been 12, 13 years. You published books all along the way. But do the books support you, or do you also? I mean, I see that you do printing. Are you a commercial printer, or do you work for other publishers? How does that work?
Yeah, it's never quite as neat as a 50-50 split, but I mean, that probably would characterize the balance to more days than not. I mean, we are a literary publisher in the old tradition, I suppose, where we, take our to make it sound formal, we take our excess production capacity and we sell it. So, we do a lot of local, basic printing, as well as doing books and letterpress printing and really fine work for people across Canada and even in the United States.
And so, you kind of would call yourself maybe a traditional job shop.
Yeah, but a traditional job shop that instead of actually, having profits, rolls that money back into the insanity of publishing literary books.
Right. So, the printing supports the press essentially.
The printing, the combination of the printing of the sort of subsidies that the federal government, in particular in Canada, sort of puts out there for literary publishing, and the sales of the books. So it's a sort of balance of those three elements.
And are all of your authors Canadian?
Primarily, I mean, I have published Thoreau, we'd like to claim him, but, generally speaking, because of the, subsidy, the subsidy available here, we've tended mostly to do Canadian authors just because that, if we don't do a Canadian author, we start, about 10 grand, and I'm picking that number out of the air, but I mean, behind the starting line compared to if we do a Canadian author.
Right. And I guess I should say for people in America who don't realize in Canada, there is a longstanding tradition of support both from the federal and sometimes from the provincial governments for literary publishing in order to, in recognition, I think, of the non-commercial nature of many literary works and the desire on the part of the country in Canada to make sure that native writing, that is to say, Canadian writers, are not lost in the vast shuffle. Particularly, I think there's a concern about being next door to the giant American cultural engine.
That's right. And there's also implicit in that is the assumption that a native, that a Canadian independent publishing company is going to make more culturally aware or different, we'll just say maybe different choices than a multinational, like Random House or HarperCollins is going to make. That if you wanted, if you really want to have a diverse culture, you have to have some companies that are able to compete, that are from there that are local, that are going to have a different, they're not just looking to sort of capitalize, they're looking to sort of build a culture, build a community. And that's where that program is, in, with the Canada Council for the Arts is the main funder, really, the Department of Canadian Heritage, these types of places. And they these programs really started through the late 1950s and early 1960s, and they've had their ups and downs, and they have their advantages and disadvantages, but it kind of replaces, you don't see the same culture of foundations here that you do, say, in the United States, you know, where if you want to run a poetry press, you really need to be the sort of non-profit that sort of, you know, wines and dines the money to populace, you know, to sort of like invest in culture. In Canada, we sort of do it publicly, I guess, instead.
Right, and that has, I think, really created a pretty dynamic and diverse group of publishers who have in Canada who have lasted quite a long time. You know, you've got the older and most established ones are Coach House and, you know, Porcupine's Quill and a bunch of others that I know from many years ago. And, of course, you've been around for 13 years. I think in America there's a more ephemeral nature to the publishing. It's more difficult, in fact, for an independent press here to sustain over a long period of time. So you've created...
We have a country where it's achievable to sort of be a press that does, you know, a small list in a specific way, and you know, just to survive doing it. You look in the United States, and it's harder. I mean, you've got to even what we would look at as a mid-sized company here, you know, something like a Douglas and McIntyre, you know, out west, or an ECW Press, or Keith Porter to a certain extent when it was around. You know, these guys are tiny still in the United States if they move those companies over, you know, across the border and tried to run them the same way. And so you've got companies like, say, Counterpoint, for example, been around forever in various guises or Copper Canyon, you know, these are really great presses that are doing really great work and literary work, and yet they're still very small players in the U.S. market and I'm sure struggle to sort of figure out how to survive.
Yeah, and I think maybe in Canada, the profile of independent literary publishers is very different. I think you're more, you know, you're more part of the general literary culture. And of course, one of the reasons that I was spurred on to talk to you was this article in the Globe and Mail about you, which mentioned this, you know, happy problem that you have, which is... A nominee for a prize. And maybe you could talk a little bit about a couple of things there. One is the book in particular, I think I'm interested in who Johannes Gibsrud is, what is the book, The Sentimentalists, and how you came to publish it, but also then talk a little bit about the challenge that a prize creates for a smaller publisher and how you're dealing with that.
Yeah, maybe I'll answer those backwards. I mean, the Giller Prize, which this book is up for, it's really the biggest, the richest prize in Canada for fiction, you know, it's been underway for a couple decades and it's well established. And it's been only recently that they sort of changed the jury structure, which seems to have, for the first time, you know, introduced some medium and smaller presses, you know, onto the list. So you know, it's really a clash of cultures in some ways, because predominantly these prizes are dominated by, you know, the big Bertelsmann subsidiaries, you know, the multi, what we call the branch plants here in Canada, derisively and to a certain extent. And so it's a bit of an odd thing, you know, when you get a literary press on that list who says, well, by, you know, we, you know, it's trickier for a literary press of our size to say, well, we're just going to, like, you know, get 50,000 copies of this book printed somewhere and, you know, meet the demand as it happens, you know. Partly why that article was in the Globe and Mail is because our press said, well, that's nice, this is a good prize, we want to sell books as much as anyone else, but we can make about 1,000 books a week, and we're making them here, deal with it. And it's a surprise to a lot of people that we would take a principled stand about, you know, that it's important to, you know, keep work in our community, that it's important to do things the way we do things, and not just make a sort of, you know, a lesser knockoff of mass market knockoff of the book. I mean, to say that, you know, we want to deal with this differently than everyone else. And it's been interesting to see how, and it continues to be interesting to see how those cultures collide, especially if we win it, which we'll find out next week. But back to your other question, Johannes Gibbsrud is an author who grew up in Nova Scotia. She's a poet. She lives in Montreal, where she's, you know, working on you know, her studies there, and I think on Wallace Stevens, if I remember right. But we published her as a poet first, and you know, published a book of poetry called Late Night with Wild Cowboys, and you know, what she did as Poetry Books in Canada did, it's, you know, sold modestly, and but we really enjoyed working with her. So she brought us this novel. We looked it over, and it was, you know, really quite good, and not the conventional Canadian "How I Spent My Summer Holidays" kind of, you know, coming of age sort of book, you know. So we took it on and you know, published it, and it toured it around a bit and promoted the book and sold, you know, 9-10 months into this project, you know, the usual 400 or 500 copies, you know, this kind of range, and the first novel by an unknown author has, and then this jury picked it as one of their books, and the whole game changed.
So, well, let's go back a little bit to the when you said you can produce 1,000 books a week, which is actually seems like a lot of books for.
Yeah, that's just ballpark, and that's on top of all my other work, right? Like, it's, yeah, I can't stop doing the you know, like, I've got this week, for example, I have the journal for the local natural society, and I have you know, flyers for somebody, and I have, you know, so this range of work. So you're trying not to bite that sort of hand that is all going to be here long after the Giller craziness dies down. So you start, you know, you serve your community, right? But at the same time, I've got to try to get as many books out there as possible. So yeah, about 1,000 a week is probably about what we can pull off.
Are you binding yourself?
Yeah, we basically, we're full print shop. So we do sell and slice and bindings and in-house, and we have a combination of, obviously here it's a combination of handwork and machinery. So so, you know, we've got a pretty good Smythe you know, signature sewer with a automatic feeder on it that, you know, you sit there and flip signatures onto it, and away they go. And but, you know, you walk around the table to collate these books, you know, right angle folders to fold them. We're running old Heidelberg cord one color presses, you know, it's up for offset. And yeah, it's a really interesting mix of old and new technology around here.
So yeah, well, and I would imagine quite a bit of work to keep those machines running at this point.
It is, but you know what? Compared to, say, a new modern shop having to capitalize to put in the brand new, you know, 8-color gigantic Heidelberg that, you know, practically, you know, does your taxes and you know, makes coffee for you. You know, if those break down, you got to hire someone from God knows where to fly in with a suitcase and full of digital stuff to fix it for you. You know, but we're kind of more like subsistence farmers down here. We sort of keep equipment running as long as possible. We've got good machinists and electricians in the area that help us keep these things on the go, and we're pretty hands-on, and we do all that stuff ourselves. So.
Well, no, what's interesting, I think, is that, you know, the digital makes the mechanical almost invisible. You know, it transforms the experience of working with machines. So I think that what you're doing, I mean, that's a whole other discussion. I think that there's a certain amount of, it's not just romanticization of mechanical work. It's that the ability to actually see what happens and to fix something when it breaks is
that's
something
right.
that we're going to lose in the transformation to digital machinery. So what you have, you know, when people talk about this with cars, I think the same thing is true with printers or printing equipment. When it breaks, you swap a black box.
You throw it away.
Right, or you swap in a box, you know, that's a black box that nobody knows what it does.
Yeah.
You know, it's a module. This piece doesn't work. Send me a new one.
Yeah.
And it does take away from one's ability to understand the process. It alienates you as a craftsperson from the work itself.
And it removes any ability for self-reliance. I mean, we dabbled in just about every corner of doing this, and from the antiquated, from casting type and all this sort of stuff to making paper. I mean, obviously, we don't make all of our paper for all our books, but, we've got a very tactile, hands-on knowledge of how that stuff works. And, particularly my business partner, Gary Dunfield, is incredibly adept. But it's on the same on the other end. I mean, we're not just Luddites. I mean, when the biggest book retailer in Canada, Chapters Indigo, announced that all of their clients were having to move over to EDI, and we do our own distribution in Canada in particular, and we were one of the first companies to comply with in-house, coded EDI program that met their standards.
Right,
so I mean, we're not just a bunch of guys with inky fingers. I mean, we're actually innovative on all ends of this process.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about the distribution. So, and we'll talk about that now. Maybe you do all of your distribution both within Canada and outside. That means you're shipping books
right
all over the world.
Yeah.
So you answered the question I was going to ask, is how do you deal with the big guys? Because EDI is challenging for a lot of the smaller and independent publishers. Plus the other issue, I guess, that you have to deal with, and I assume it's the same with Chapters Indigo as it is with other chains, you get returns.
Yeah, and we've had a really tricky time, particularly, we haven't sold in any volume outside of Canada. We sold sort of in ones and twos, but in Canada, even though we were cautious, we got into some trouble over the past few years with Chapters Indigo making huge dumps of stale, dated, and damaged books back on us. As a way of sort of capitalizing, financing their own financial ups and downs, so they've just dumped stuff back on publishers. And it's kind of an unfortunate practice. It's a hard one to sort of police. It's a hard one to sort of take your really the biggest retailer, a monopoly essentially in a country like ours. And you can't do much about it other than be cautious how you sell to them. So we've taken. Since then, actually, in fairness to them, it's gotten better, I think. I mean, there's still been that whole kind of mass market side of the industry is still insane, really. It doesn't really work. But Chapters Indigo, by and large, has improved dramatically over the past 4 years or so in terms of ordering more smarter, returning quicker if they're going to return. So, if the publisher's responsible and they continue to kind of, because they don't like losing money either. I mean, it's no good for anybody when they return books, frankly. I'm hopeful that if everybody's cautious, and everybody sort of understands, you can't really expect them to behave like a real bookstore because they're not a real bookstore. They're more like Costco or one of the, some huge, giant retailer. That they're selling widgets and it's not the same as dealing with a mom and pop independent bookstore that really orders smart and orders careful and knows their business.
So do you still have, in America, the independent stores have been declining in number for years, and I think that's happened in Canada as well. As the stores are, shall we say, there are fewer of them, do you sell direct to consumer? It's a balancing act for a publisher because you want to be able to support your network of retailers. You don't want to compete with them. But at the same time, there are plenty of places where there aren't bookstores or where maybe there are people who don't want to buy electronically or they don't want to buy online and they do, they want your books. So how do you sell direct to consumer as well?
We do, but that represents a pretty small part of our business in Canada because there are still a number of good independents around. And a lot of people do use the online services like Amazon and, the Chapters online site and so on. That probably represents a larger part of our sales that are not as, the traditional retail over-the-counter sales. But it's more outside of Canada that we're doing a lot more direct sales to consumers. It's funny that people talk about the future of the book and what where we're headed, you know. And the people I'm most worried about are the independent booksellers. And, you know, if you look at the book industry like in ecology, you know, you worry about when you see it, some one part of one species drop out, you know, suddenly, you know, because it does affect everybody else. Eventually, it ripples up, it ripples down. And so I worry about these independent booksellers and what happens as they kind of go into decline. And something like the electronic books, you know, it's not really going to hurt publishers exactly. I mean, someone still has to put the content together. Someone still has to sort of, you know, perform that role. But it's the booksellers, I think, that are really going to be the ones hurt by, you know, as electronic books become more and more common. They're the ones that are going to get hurt.
You know, I think that's true, and I think that there's a loss there that's significant in terms of a sensibility of community. And as you said, I think the ecological descriptors are, in fact, accurate, that it's sort of when you have independent stores going away, it's like it is like losing a piece of an ecosystem. And
for sure,
of course, there are adaptations, you know, that things change. But I think for every change that adds, there's also a change, you know, there's the component of loss. And it's possible that, you know, that it is possible that someone will envision and create a new way of serving that need. I mean, there is a certain, I think, need that people have in terms of interaction with culture that involves human contact versus, you know, everything being done by machines. You know, I think that, you know, human beings want contact with each other. That's why Facebook is so popular.
I think in some ways we're going to see perhaps a move back to a more traditional model, I suppose. I mean, we're kind of already partly on that path where we've reunited this idea that, you know, a publisher that does its own production, you know, that does its own printing. I mean, that's an old idea. That's nothing new. And but it's uncommon, you know, in this sort of age of, you know, where we break down things into little parts and specialize everything. And so, you know, where you're doing your own production and you're doing your own distribution, you're doing your own, you know, all the editorial and design aspects that, you know, under one roof, a small group of people intimately involved with that. And, you know, what we may end up finding is that, just like in the early days of the printing press, that, publishers have to become more and more involved in retail as they lose those key clients, you know, in the retail sector. So that you know, it used to be you'd go into, you know, and you'd be in Antwerp in, you know, in the 1570s or something, and you'd go into Christopher Platten's print shop to see what the latest books were, and you would buy, and perhaps he would not even have his books, but he'd have books from other shops to some extent, you know. This is the way it used to work, and it may end up back there again somehow.
I think you're right. I think actually the future for publishers is to become more involved with the actual end user, which has not been the case for many years because there was an ecosystem of intermediaries that may not be there anymore. Now, let me ask you this sort of...
I want to add one more thing to that before we depart from it, and that's that one of the key problems for publishing, I think, has been that, especially in Canada, it's been invisible to some extent. I mean, not entirely, but, you know, whether it's the bureaucrats that in the government that we deal with or the end reader, you know, of a book, publishers are seen as just a delivery mechanism, you know, in some ways. And unless we sort of reimagine publishing as being its own creative act that is critical to the culture and critical to the literary culture in particular, then, you know, we're endangering ourselves. So part of that becomes something we've been trying to do here. I mean, normally in literature, the author is the brand. I mean, nobody remembers who cares who published the last, you know, best-selling book. I mean, I don't know who published The Da Vinci Code. I mean, I can't remember, you know. But so it's the title or it's the author who is the brand. And one of the things we've been trying to do is to make sure that Gaspereau is actually, a known entity, among the readers that pick up our books. And when you pick up a book, you know it's a Gaspar book. It matters that it's a Gaspar book. It's evident immediately it's a Gaspar book. And that becomes part of what you care about, and part of why you're buying that book. I mean, it needs to be a good book, too, but so until the publishers sort of find a way to sort of become part of the brand again, then they're also in danger, perhaps.
Well, and that's actually a really good point. I think that the publisher does need to establish brand, and I think it's partially by look and feel, but I also think it must be by selection and kind of coherency in the work published, because... Yeah. Otherwise, what does the brand mean? And, of course, that raises the question that I wanted to ask you about in terms of electronic publishing, digital publishing. You do ebooks now, as you said before. Your model seems to be able to do everything, to do all the parts of being a publisher. Now, does that mean you're also converting all of your books and building a workflow that accommodates electronic publishing along the same path as pre-publishing?
And we're really just starting into that. I mean, actually, this Giller-nominated book that we have, it was the first foray into that world. Because up to this point, we've kind of been waiting to see how it settles out, as far as which formats are going to be, adopted. And we're really committed to the physical book. I think it's the main show, and it will continue to be the main show for a long time. What electronic books? I mean, there are many wonderful things about electronic books, and there are many useful things about them. And I think it's a good complement. But I think that really, if you're going to, it's just, well, it's ephemeral. It's disembodied in a lot of ways. So it has a limited function, but it's not to be poo-pooed, it's not to be sort of taken lightly. So we're trying to find what that balance is going to be.
I think it's going to be, I think you'll just have to see how it goes. But does that mean that are you able to produce electronic books in all formats? Are you focusing on a couple? I'm just curious about that.
At this point, we've only dabbled with the Kobo, which is, I don't know if that's available in the U.S. as well. I actually just started to look into it in the last little while. So we haven't actually, we're really early days in the electronic book side. I can't see why we wouldn't be. We have the technological savvy around here to be able to pretty much keep up with whatever's asked of us, I suppose, so. And part of our issue right now as a small company is time. That's trying to, like you say, work that into the workflow. It's always tricky to go back and grab backlist and work your way through that. So I'm really curious to see where we are able to go with it. But the assumption is often, though, because we put such a sort of premium around here on the physical book. I think almost daily I have someone comment to me about, oh, geez, e-books must really bug you. It's like, but why would they? I mean, it's a different thing. It's like saying you don't like knives because you've got a fork. they do something different and complementary. There's nothing to be gained by sort of being. What I do worry about is that, as usual, when you're dealing with some government subsidies and so on, there's always a sort of mania, that sort of come around where they develop a new program that diverts attention and funds away from the core activities of a publishing house towards whatever's trendy. And so that's more what I keep my eye open for, is to, and to resist those kinds of, being pushed where someone else thinks I should go. We've got to size this up for ourselves and figure out how do we integrate this in a sane and functional way without just being led.
Well, I think that's actually a really admirable approach. And I think, if you can keep to that, I think you'll be very successful in figuring out how things are going to work. It's been great talking to you, Andrew. I really appreciate you taking the time because I know you're busy with all the things you've done. This has been Publishing Talks. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Andrew Steeves from Gaspar Press in Kentfield, Nova Scotia. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.